brain fog, insomnia, moodiness, achy joints, weight gain. Maybe you're thinking they're all just part of getting older. Or that's what your doctor tells you. But Midi Health understands that for women over 40, they can all be connected. Hormonal changes that happen during perimenopause and menopause are at the root of dozens of symptoms women experience, not just hot flashes. Midi specializes in compassionate care for women in menopause. Their solutions are safe, effective, and FDA approved. Plus, they're covered by insurance. A convenient telehealth visit with a Midi clinician can be your first step to getting personalized care. They'll tailor a treatment plan for your symptoms and health history so you can get back to feeling great. 91% of MIDI patients get relief from symptoms within just 2 months. When your body changes, your care should too. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is Success Made to Last, our legend show, and we've got a great one on today. Clayton Cameron is a hero of mine, and he is known for his dynamic drumming and his experimentation and his perfection of the art of brush technique. I brought mine today here just to show you.
Very good.
Get a little lesson in here for somebody who's played drums for 60 years. Clayton has toured with none other than Sammy Davis Jr., Tony Bennett, jazz legends like George Shearing, Joe Pass, Joe Williams. And during Cameron's time with Tony Bennett, the group performed with others like Frank Sinatra, Billy Joel, Sting, Elvis Costello, James Taylor, you name it. And he's an author and he's a lecturer. It is an honor to get to honor you today, Mr. Clayton Cameron. Welcome to Legends.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, aside from all that oozing love and admiration for you, tell us the rest of your story, starting with where are you from and where did you get the bug to play drums?
Yeah, I'm from Los Angeles, California. I mean, I was born and raised in an area, right, they call it Mid-City. You don't hear that very often, but it's pretty much, you know, not far from Hollywood, not far from the beach, not far. It's kind of like, as the title says, Mid-City, right near La Cienega and Venice Boulevard next to Culver City. And so I grew up there. And from the age, from the early age of about 6 years old, I recall, you know, really banging on things. And I had a next door neighbor that was a photographer who was cleaning out his studio, and one of the props was like three bongos. And so he was cleaning out his studio one day, and I saw the box with the toys and stuff, and the bongos caught my eye, and he gave them to me. And so that kind of started me, you know, being recognized by my family of some little, you know, that he likes drums. And so yeah. I used to play those things every friggin' day. And I think I got them over the summer. So it was like a great summer because I was just playing bongos in the backyard all the time. And then a neighbor of mine was a professional hand percussionist, conga, more like an African-style drumming. And he, named Mr. Schamberger, and Mr. Schamberger would hear me, and then he asked my parents, you know, hey, can he come over and play with me? And his son and I were the same age, so it wasn't like anything unusual. So, but I had never been in his studio. So he had a little studio, and I go back in, and so I played with him, and I never thought anything of it. Years later, when I was a professional, I was touring in Hawaii, and he was living there at the time. He came to the show, and he said, yeah, I told your dad that you had some talent. I was like, oh, you told my dad I had talent? He said, yeah. And I told him to get you some drums. And so it was crazy because one day there was just some drums in my living room that my dad, based on what Mr. Schamberger had said, had gone out and got these drums. And my mom said, oh, no, you're not going to play those drums in the house unless you take lessons. So she found a studio, a little music school in mid-city L.A., not far at all. In fact, by the time I started taking lessons at 12. And so, you know, after a while, I would just take, you know, hop on a bus. It was like a 15-minute bus ride. And it was like the highlight of my week every week to hop on the bus and go take a drum lesson, you know. So that's how I started. And, you know, my first teacher was this guy by the name, a beautiful drummer by the name of Raymond Pounds, who, you know, was primarily working with people like Stevie Wonder and doing, you know, sessions for James Brown and that sort of thing. And so he was not known in the jazz world, but he was just a great drummer all around. And he grew up with the likes of Patrice Rushen and pianist Patrice Rushen and drummer Ndugu Chancellor. They all went to Locke High School. So I had, you know, some really great teachers and mentors coming up like Billy Higgins, you know, so I was part of that whole Leimert Park world stage group, you know, of kids coming up where Billy Higgins would mentor you.
What a great journey. And when you look back on it, I'd love for you to give some advice to the parents and grandparents out there. You said you were 12. How young is young enough to be able to start to pick up the skills as a percussionist?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of just, you know, letting kids play, you know, without too much of a formal instruction early on, if they're around it and the instruments are there and they want to bang on them and play them, strum them, whatever, I think that's great. You know, I mean, I've heard some, you know, it just depends on the child, right? Like some kids learn how to read early, you know, just, you know, read books early. And, you know, that kid might be the candidate for, you know, someone who might want to start learning how to read music as well. But I think the most important thing, if they're going to start early, just let them play, just let them, you know, do their thing. And if it's possible to play with other people, like I did, you know, I played with Mr. Schamberger, you know, it was a highlight. I wasn't, you know, he didn't give me instruction or anything. We just played, you know? So I think just, you know, doing that, it's just as a kid would go out with a soccer ball, you know, you give them a few little tips on how to hit the ball, kick it. But then after that, you just play, you know? So I think it's the same. And I think it, you know, in terms of the way our brains work and how kids are, you know, every kid's going to be different, but I would just say, let them play.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. I also want to thank our mutual friend, Angie Wells, for introducing us. And we so enjoyed that conversation with her and understanding how she evolved as a singer. And I'm sitting here today with my Vic Firth brushes. And I remember playing something to Petticoat Junction when I was growing up. That was my first introduction to that. And I'm wondering, when did you turn to brushes as your distinction?
Well, you know, I never really had any brush lessons, per se. And when I did, the one lesson that I did have, I was very disappointed in it. So for me, it was kind of like a fear factor. I heard that, you know, jazz musicians, you know, if you play jazz, you needed to know how to play brushes. So I was so afraid that I'd be embarrassed that, you know, I just would try to listen to anybody that I saw live play brushes. Yes. You know, trying to decipher from the records was, you know, another thing, you know, that was later on in life that would become much easier. But in the beginning, it was kind of like, you know, I have no idea what they're doing. So, you know, for me, it really struck me in college when I was doing a rehearsal with a trio, piano. Well, actually, it was a quartet, piano, bass, drums, and a saxophonist. And so they called a ballad. And I remember saying to myself, okay, I'm just going to pull out the brushes and try to stay out of the way. And so the saxophonist, after he was probably maybe 2 years older than me. So it wasn't like he was like some seasoned veteran, but he turned around to me and said, after we played the tune, he says, you should take brushes more seriously. And I was like, it was like somebody just punched you in the stomach. And I was like, oh, you know, I was like, okay, you're like a saxophone player. For him to say that, and it really set me on the journey to really try to listen and find out more about the tool. And so I did, you know. And so when I graduated from college, you know, all my playing was, you know, based on listening to records. And then if I could see anybody live. In fact, I remember one time I went to see Elvin Jones at the Lighthouse out here in Hermosa Beach, a very famous jazz club at the time. And I went in to see Elvin, and I said, "Mr. Jones, are you going to play brushes tonight?" Because I really wanted to see what he would do with brushes. Yeah. And he said, "Oh, you like brushes, huh?" And I said, "Yeah, I really like brushes." And he didn't play any brushes that night. But he played everything else. It was great. But I would see him years later, when I was touring with Tony Bennett, and I was living in New York, and I went to see him down at the Blue Note in the Village. And he did play brushes that night. And I copped the slickest. It was such a slick groove, man. I copped that thing. I went home and practiced as soon as I got home. It was so slick and so Elvin-ish, you know. So it was him. You know, you would never teach somebody to play brushes like he was playing, but it was so hip. So I copped that vibe that he got with the brushes.
Oh, that's such a great story. Critical to one of the things you just stated was stay out of the way. Stay out of the way. That's totally foreign to a lot of drummers. What do you think that means today?
Well, for me, you know, back then, you know, I did stay out of the way, but then I didn't really contribute either, you know, according to the saxophone player. But I think, you know, it's just like anything else, just playing like if you're playing something that has clave, if you play something outside the clave, you're not staying out of the way, right? You're getting in the way of it. If you're playing some sort of funk groove and you're playing something that has nothing to do with that, then you're getting in the way. You're not playing what's needed, you know. So I think really just playing what's needed and embellishing. And I'm not saying that it you know what you're playing is simple. I mean, you can think of, you know, all kinds of things. Elvin could get, you know, be playing all this stuff and he wasn't in the way, you know. But it was because it was contributing to the music that he was playing. So it just depends on what the music is and just try to, you know, really speaking the language of what's needed, you know.
You got it. We're speaking right now with legendary drummer, the Brushmaster, Mr. Clayton Cameron. He's had videos out. He's got a great book out. I watched one of your videos in the last day or so, and I'm going to give you a quick review on 17 brush rudiments that you have originated. I felt comfortable on the tap sweep, and the further you went into the rudiments, I went, "Oh no!" And by the time I got to the paraphraditle, and I knew what paraphraditle meant, in a slitter tap, in a slitter sweet tap, but the one that just tore me up, I went. Also known now as God gave you great wrist.
Yeah, well, the trill, I mean, you have to, it's like anything else. I mean, you have to do it really slow, and then you just try to get that, build that muscle memory, and then find the balance, you know, find out where the sweet spot is to do it. Yeah.
Sure. But there's the end of it, though, was like, I had to almost drop to the floor because you were playing a flex long roll, which, folks, if you know anything about drumming, it's a single stroke. And it's like it's almost like the film sped up because you were going, you know, your wrists were just on fire and there's smoke coming off of them. And so that leads me to this. And it's a question about practicing. A lot of people don't like to practice today. And I would love for you to comment on what's the value of practice and why do you need to practice and continue to challenge yourself at new strokes?
Well, look, I mean, if we think of drums as any musician would think of their instrument, is that you want to be, you know, as fluid on it as possible. And so there are certain, you know, and I don't care what the style of music is, you know, you want to be able to approach the instrument in such a way that you're able to express yourself, you know, basically express yourself through the instrument and be able to execute the things that you were thinking about. You know, so you need to have coordination, you know, and I say five-way coordination, because you need to be able to count and then do all the other four limbs while you're counting. So that way, you know, your coordination is really grounded, you know. So, you know, you have to practice that. But if you, you know, if you're just going to sit down and you want to play one beat all your life, then you know, you're cool. You know, you're not really, you know, that's okay. You know, so if you don't have higher aspirations.
Okay for the board people of the world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so yeah, if you're not going to challenge yourself. So yeah, so, you know, it's just like, and I call the, you know, rudiments are, now look, if you think about other cultures that don't use Western music notation, you know, things are passed on orally. You know, even if you just sat down and just trying to play a second line beat, you know, all the little nuances over there, that is coming from a rudimentary background, but then was made into grooves from the musicians in New Orleans, you know, because basically all the most of the rudiments that that we got from the past are military exercises. So when you hear a count off or a drum off, blah blah, blah blah, blah blah. Okay, so that's, what do you want to do after that? You want to march. So those things were used in militarily to give signals. It's not probably the best thing to use drums, and they stopped using them, and trumpets to, you know, to do formations and all that, because everybody knew where you were, you know, you get shot. So those military, those rudiments would tie, where jazz musicians would take those rudiments and make them into something, you know, that was flavorful, as opposed to military. So, you know, they're like scales for drummers, but a lot of drummers don't practice them. A lot of drummers, you know, and I'm not saying that you have to do it, but it certainly makes things a little more accessible when you're first starting out. If you can learn, you know, all 26 standard rudiments, if you will, it just makes things so much more accessible in terms of like scales for, you know, someone who plays a horn or piano. So I look at it that way. They're really kind of like scales. And so that's what I was doing with the brush movements, or rudiments, I like to call them. And I am working on a book to do that too, just kind of put those out, because that's only 17 rudiments. I have all kinds of other combinations and stuff. But the thing about it is, I created those for myself, because once I saw, when I was working with Sammy Davis Jr., and I saw him and his buddies during one show. His buddies were Sandman Sims. These are all tap dancers. Sandman Sims, Arthur Duncan, and Bunny Briggs. And then a couple of nights, Gregory Hines showed up. Man, these guys are doing all this stuff, all these different combinations, they call them. For us, it would be kind of like rudiments. So they were doing all these things. And I said, oh, man, let me try to play that. Let me, you know, that particular dance step. Let me, where he's sliding his foot and tapping and everything is in time, you know. So it wasn't like, you know, where it was like some rubato solo where you just got to play what you wanted. No, everything was in a groove. And so that's when I started creating. I said, well, maybe I can create some.
Bluey, Bingo, Bandit, and Chili are coming to the Long Center March 16th and 17th.
Do you want to play musical statues with us?
Join the Healers for the return of their live stage show, Bluey's Big Play.
Look, Mom!
Don't miss Bluey, brought to real life in this fun-filled show made for the whole family. Tickets for Bluey at the Long Center on March 16th and 17th are on sale now at longcenter.org. That's longcenter.org. Bluey!
If you've ever wanted a custom plate, come explore all the different ways you can express your personality and interest with My Plates. MyPlates.com is Texas's one-stop plate shop for all specialty and personalized plates in Texas, where you get to choose your own unique message, background, and even symbols. At My Plates, you can honor your school, your country, or just have a little bit of fun. My Plates helps you choose from over 500 Texas license plate styles, many starting as low as $30 per year. Create yours at MyPlates.com. Whatever you're looking for, they've got that at MyPlates.com.
Some muscle memory by doing certain things. So the first rudiment that I had created was, I said, well, I know how to do a paradiddle. What if I do a paradiddle instead of doing tapping diddles, I'll do sweeping diddles. Mm-hmm. And so then that's when I created, that was the first rudiment I created, was the paraslittle. And so that's based on a paradiddle, but sweeping the diddle instead of tapping it. And then I ran into Billy Higgins at a Remo event, and I was explaining to him I think I was just showing him paraslittle and maybe some other combinations, paraslittle, diddle, that sort of thing. And so he said, well, Clayton, what about perpetual motion? And I said, what do you mean, you know, Billy? And he says, and so he does this thing, like if you were to, like, if you imagine someone on a boxing bag, you know, where your hands are going one over the other. You see that bag going back and forth, and so the hand is going in a round motion. Well, he did like a reverse motion of that and doing double strokes, double stroke rolls, like an old school kind of like, you know, going backwards and doing double strokes. And so it was like a perpetual, like you're on a wheel, like a hamster wheel. And so I said, oh, wow, that's cool. And so that's when I came up with the tap sweep. So the tap sweeps are really, you tap the first note and then you sweep the second note on the diddle. So it's just really a double stroke roll, but you tap the first and you slide the second. Tap the first, slide the second. But then you do it in a perpetual motion. I don't say that in the book, but that's the best way to do it, because that's, you know, what Billy was showing me. And so I just emulated what Billy was doing. And so that came with, that was my second rudiment. Or Willie, that was the first of the tap sweeps. The other rudiments that I had come up with were all based on the paraslittle. So paraslittle diddle, that sort of thing. And then the second series was based on the tap sweep that Billy Higgins, basically influenced me into. So yeah. Anyway, that was a long answer on something I,
No. That's beautiful. I heard tap dancing in that 17 rudiments. And I was fortunate to get to see Mr. Hines before he passed. And I hear that shh, I hear the brush now. So mm-hmm. There's, other than tap, what other sounds in this world have influenced how you brush?
Yeah, well, a lot of the stuff did come from, you know, watching Gregory and, you know, Sandman Sams, Arthur Duncan, and Sammy Davis Jr. Over a 2-week period, I just had an epiphany. And so there was one guy by the name of, you know, Bunny Briggs. And Bunny Briggs had this kind of rapid fire tap, and, you know, where he would, you know, get multiple beats by in one motion, you know. Hmm. And so, like a 5-stroke roll almost. And it would just be with one motion. So he would hit his heel, toe kind of thing and just let it go. And so, but it was very close to the floor. He didn't move a whole lot, but he got all this rapid fire tap. So anyway, so the rim flexes that you talked about, and that's where I take the shaft of the brush, because this is radio, I try to describe it. Take the shaft of the brush and I make contact with the rim of the drum with my hand below the rim. And okay. Then I pronate up into the head of the drum. You see, the wire, when I first strike, it doesn't hit the drum, because you don't want to do that, because it'll cut off the vibration. So you want the wire to flex. So my hand is below the drum, and the wire is moving, and then I pronate around the rim, and I strike, and then the wires will touch the head. So, and they'll touch how many ever times that, you know, how much energy you put up. I can usually get maybe, the most I can get is probably 5 touches. But the main thing is, the true thing that you want to do is be able to control like 2 touches. So that's the way I can get the multiple you know, the long stroke roll, that sort of thing, where every time I strike the rim, I'm getting two rim flexes. So if I go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and those are 16 notes, it's going to sound like 32nd notes because I'm getting two touches from the wire for every strike on the rim.
That makes sense. The longer you go through that 17, I hope, folks, that you're not nearly as intimidated as me. be inspired and keep practicing. We're going to take a quick break, and I'm going to throw this to you, Clayton. Tell us where people can contact you, buy your music, follow you, see you in concert, buy your book, etc. So this belongs to you.
Yeah, my email, if you ever need to contact me, is the letter C, brushman@gmail.com. And the only real social media I do is Facebook and Instagram. So all my gigs, I usually post on that, you know, when they're coming up. And in terms of my book, that you can just go to Amazon.com and, you know, you can purchase it there. And I'm working on reissuing The Living Art of Brushes with new material, but using the old material as well. I know that it's up online on like YouTube and all of that kind of stuff, you know, where people are pirating it. But I'm going to reissue it with, you know, new explanations, kind of like I'm doing right now, just talking about things and how they came up, that sort of thing.
Very good. And when will I be able to buy brushes that have your name on them, or are they already available?
Yeah, funny you should ask that. Well, you know, for years I was with the Regal Tip Company, which was a great relationship. I was signed to them when Joe Collado was living, you know, and that was back in 1990. Mm-hmm. And so that series has just ended, and I'm got another series coming up and soon to be announced. So once we're done with all the little specs on it, that'll be announced, the launching of a new Clayton Cameron brush. So that'll be coming up this year.
Excellent. A trivia question for you. How many wires are in here?
That's funny.
No, just kidding. I want to send... Go ahead. Unless you know it, but that's okay. I want to send greetings from Charlie Pecoraro, who was the bartender at Catalina Club.
Oh, Charlie. Yeah.
And he sends his big hug to you. And there was one question that came out when I was talking to Charlie, and we were talking about, it's so weird. I was in a jazz band in Denver, and we were called the Terra Gatos, which was like Earth Cats. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the jazz band had a name that was associated with an animal. And I wonder today, coming in, if someone has ever called you a brush-tail cat or a brush-tail cat?
No, I've never had that one.
Have you ever had anybody? Why do we have this compunction to call each other animal names in the jazz world?
You know, I think that was part of the, you know, colloquial language, you know, with musicians early on back in the 40s, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah. It started with that, you know, where, you know, it was kind of like guys taking ownership. You know, there was this whole thing. There's a great book called written on Thelonious Monk, and the writer is named Robin Kelly. And he had a chapter, and not a chapter, but there's a piece in there where the musicians of the 40s, you know, with all the civil rights, you know, we're in the 40s, so there's no civil rights and all that going on. It was still like some Jim Crow things. But the musicians started referring to each other as, hey, man, what's up? Because they were combating the old Southern, you know, thing of people calling them boy. And so that started the whole nickname thing where, you know, addressing each other as men. Say, hey, man, what's up? You know, hey, man, I'm good. How are you? I'm all right, man. You all right? You know, and then Dizzy Gillespie, you know, of course, took it to another level. So he, you know, Dizzy had all kinds of nicknames. So, you know, so it started with the jazz musicians just, you know, really addressing each other, and then the admiration they had for each other, and, you know, the respect they had for each other and for themselves. Yeah.
I love that. I still don't know some of the names of the band members there in Denver. I only know them by their animal names.
That's funny. That's funny.
Okay. We are going to wrap this conversation up with Mr. Clayton Cameron, and I've got just a couple more questions for you. I would be remiss if I didn't have you recall one of your favorite drumming moments with all the variety of people that you've ever played behind. What are those one or two memories that you've got that you would want to share with us today?
Oh, wow. Well, I have some, you know, like in my top five experiences, I'll name the people. One is with Miles Davis. One is with Max Roach. One is with Tony Williams. Another is with James Brown. So pick one of those.
Gosh. Let's take Max.
Okay.
Sorry about Max.
Yeah, so back in 1989, I was producing the Living Art of Brushes. I had written a storyboard. I hadn't shot anything yet, but I was really concerned about the project because I felt that, you know, Ed Thigpen was still alive and Philly Joe Jones, all these guys that I respected, Vanel Fournier, all these guys were still alive. So I was like, well, why am I doing this? You know, they could do it, you know, but I had a concept and now it's known. I mean, the Living Art of Brushes was the first instructional video to have that overhead camera. And then I threw the whole idea I had was to throw graphics over one of the hands while the two hands are moving to isolate that so people could see the pattern. That was the whole concept of it. The idea of all the other things that I did. Oh, wait, hold on a second. I got to move. Yeah, I'm in my studio, and so if you don't move around for a while, the lights go out. I had the storyboard, and I was talking to a fellow musician by the name of Lisa Terry, and she is a violinist, and she played with Max Roach in what they called his double quartet. So it was a jazz quartet with a string quartet. And so I was explaining, we were good friends from college, and I was explaining my project to her, and she said to me, "Oh, well, you know, you should, you know who you should show that to? You should show that to Max." And I said, "Max who?" And she goes, "Max Roach." I said, "Max Roach?" She says, "Yeah." She goes, "Yeah, we're having a party. You know, we're going to be playing at the Catalinas this weekend, tomorrow night, starting tomorrow night. And we're having a party tomorrow night before, you know, tomorrow afternoon before the show. So you should come to the party and show Max." I was like, "Are you? Oh my God!" My brain—I couldn't even handle it. So I get to the party and I have my binder underneath my arm, and I just felt so out of place. I see Max, and I'm just like, I can't even believe that Max Roach is in the same room. And she says I should go talk to him. Now, if I had my wits about me, I would have just said, "Hey, Lisa, can you introduce me to Max?" But I was just so like foregone. I was just like, "Oh my God, I got to talk to Max." And so I'm watching him and, you know, I'm tapping my foot nervously. And so and then I feel uncomfortable because I got this binder underneath my arm. I'm like, I look so like conspicuous. So finally, you know, Max sits down. I see him sit down on a couch and he sits at the end of the couch and he has food. And so I was like, "Oh my God, I can't interrupt him while he's eating. That's so rude, you know." But then I was thinking, he's probably going to leave right after he eats, and then I won't have. So I had all these things going in my head, right? I was just so finally I got up enough nerve, and I went up and I kneeled down at the end of the couch. You know, it was one of those, you know, couch gets to sit about three or four people, and so I kneeled down. I said, "Hi, Mr. Roach. My name's Clayton. I'm a drummer." He said, "Yeah." He said, "I thought you were a drummer. I saw you tapping your foot over there." And I was thinking, no, that was me nervously shaking my foot. I was thinking to myself. And so I said, "You know, I have this project I'd like to share with you." He says, "Oh, yeah?" He says, "Yeah." I said, so I opened it up and I had every camera shot of each lesson. And so I opened up to the first page and I You know, it was like, you know, showing a pattern and blah, blah, blah. And Max is looking at it, and I go to the next one. So he puts his food down and he goes, well, let me see that. He goes to, now, mind you, I've shared this with other people before and, you know, got no interest. Like, yeah, whatever. But now the great Max Roach is going through each page and he looks up at me. He goes, do you mean like this? And he's doing his hands as if he were playing the pattern, you know? And I go, I get all excited. I go, yeah, that's it. And I was like, oh my God, Max gets it. And he goes through the whole storyboard, you know, every page. And it was several pages, it was a lot of pages. And then he said, man, this is genius. Oh my God. And he says, if you need any help, you let me know. I thought I was going to faint. And so he had to leave. It's just as I thought he had to leave. And I said, Mr. Roach, I said, would you mind if I quoted you on that, on that genius thing? And he said, yeah, go right ahead. And so that's what I did when the cover came out, Max Roach, genius. So that was my Max Roach, you know, that really gave me all the confidence to finish the project.
Wow. That is a story that should be the capstone of this interview. There's nothing more legendary than a legend of the past saying something like that to you and the path that he sent you on.
Oh, yeah. No, that was truly, it's just like I didn't talk to anyone, you know, any drummers or any of my teachers, anything after that. I was just like, let me just finish the project. And I did. And when it came out, it was very well received.
Oh, yeah. That's so wonderful. Mr. Cameron, it's been an honor to honor you. And like I told you earlier today, you are one of my heroes. And I hope that you continue your work and teach the next generation. And whenever anybody wants to come see you play, wherever you are in the United States, what's the best way to find out where you may be performing?
Yeah, follow me on Facebook. I always post on there. That's the easiest. That's the easiest way. Very good. I'm just so you know, I'm in my teaching studio at UCLA. So I'm you know, I teach. I've been at UCLA for 18 years teaching drummers and musicians. So I'm still that's a big something I enjoy as well. So
you bet. You've moved from success to significance. Now you're. Your long shadow will be seen for generations to come, hopefully with all those wonderful drummers out there.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. And thanks again to our friend, Angie Wells. Folks, as we always say here, we wish you great success, but on your way to significance. Have a good one.
It's time to find the power in your numbers. With Xero. That's Xero spelled X-E-R-O. Xero is accounting software that gives you financial visibility. Learn more at xero.com. Xero, accounting software for better business.